Escape Pod. Episode 223. Today's story: The Uncanny Valley by Nick Marmatas.
Hello, and welcome to Escape Pod, the weekly science fiction podcast. I'm Norm Sherman. In 1978, a Japanese roboticist and Skynet employee named Masahiro Mori was at his desk, like usual, pondering how one might be able to destroy the entire human race using malevolent androids, when he noticed something interesting. The more human-like his robots became, the more people seemed to like them, but only up to a certain point. If they became too lifelike and realistic, suddenly people were repelled and put ill at ease. "Son of a bitch," he huffed, as he was then forced to scrap the entire line of brand spankin' new Mecha Oprah android warriors. "Such a waste," he thought. "You know, maybe I'll save just one of these little fellas. What harm could just one of them do, you know?" This phenomenon Masahiro Mori called the Uncanny Valley. When an android looks like C-3PO, we think it's cute, and he can be one of our bros. But when a robot becomes 99% lifelike, so close that it's almost like us, we start focusing on that missing 1%. We start noticing the subtle drooping in his pudgy skin, the odd hue of his gray, buzz-cut hair, the seemingly contrived nature to his weeping and ranting on his Fox television show. We love C-3PO, but the minute he becomes Glenn Beck, we freak the hell out. It's the paradoxical point when a simulation becomes so good, it's bad. It's why some people didn't like the new Beowulf movie. "Angelina's boobs were just fine the way they were, thank you very much." It's also probably why people are oftentimes way more critical of hard SF, letting illogical development slide in other softer genres. So with that in mind, we come to this week's story, The Uncanny Valley by Nick Marmatas. Nick is the author of two novels, Move Underground and Under My Roof, and over 50 short stories. Much of his short fiction, including the novelette The Uncanny Valley, was recently collected in the book You Might Sleep. With Ellen Datlow, Nick is co-editing the anthology Haunted Legends, due from Tor Books in 2010. This story first appeared in the anthology Polyphony 6. The story is read to you by the lovely Kate Baker, the podcast director for Hugo and World Fantasy Award nominee Clark's World Magazine, and production manager for The Sofanauts. She can be heard narrating for Starship Sofa, Clark's World, Escape Pod, and Fantasy Magazine. So say goodbye to fish sticks and tasteful nudity, and say hello to the future, because it's story time.
The Uncanny Valley by Nick Marmatas. The trouble with knowing everything there is to know, Stephanie Dowling decided instantly, because that's how clever she was that when there was something unknown out there, she had nobody to consult. And there was something unknown out there nibbling away at the edge of the economy and screwing with the Cotrell cockshot tetanmonts sufficiently that there'd be problems. Shortages of essentials, power cells and answer boxes, ridiculous surpluses of nonsense like chrome and diamonds. She could tell because the bride was coughing between her lines and the donkey she rode on suddenly looked ill. It would be just like... what's his name? That old thing. Capitalism. Till she fixed it anyway. What's his name? Stephanie had forgotten something. For a moment. Shit. Stephanie squinted, took a stretch, and yawned. It was a nervous twitch she had picked up from her old father, as of course she never tired. Then she turned back to her ubiquitous computing interface, a cyclorama Bollywood musical cast with jerky clockwork automata, and saw that all the characters were dead, slumped over or flat on the floor, stiff in pools of corn syrup blood. Then a gleaming metal hand punched a hole through her back and came out her chest, showing Stephanie her heart right before she died. Every other member of the post office in the world saw it too. and for the first time since convergence, they became afraid. The problem, I explained, though it hardly needed any explanation because I was addressing the 2,500 posty know-it-alls who had already predicted what I was going to say, and it was already an old joke, is that idiots post-convergence only become faster idiots. The cymbal-banging monkey on my desk slowed its rate of beat as I stubbed out my cigarette. Esme, please. A girl was murdered. Jeremiah Baldwin wasn't even a tenth the actor his grandfather or great-uncles had been, but since convergence, he took a special joy in channeling the talents of his betters. Now he offered up Gielgud's quiet air of desperation. Thankfully, I never liked Gielgud. Yes, and you're all traumatized now because all you posty saw it through your little peepers. Poor, poor ruling class. The monkey stopped. I lit another cigarette. A girl wasn't murdered. How can someone even murder one of the post office? A snowflake doesn't fall anymore without you all agreeing that it should. I'm sorry this visit upsets you, Esme. Selective omniscience actually makes one a poor conversationalist. So Jeremiah made the obvious idiotic small talk. Your toy measures your stress, but isn't it stressful to hear and watch it go when you're more relaxed? The monkey's arms slowly brought the cymbals together as I sank back into my Aeron. I had the little bastards. Maybe I like having a little positive feedback stressor. We need your help. Chung, 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 went my monkey happily. Oh, has post office collectively diagnosed themselves with PTSD? Good thing I kept my office after the convergence. And here you are again. I guess old habits die hard for the both of us, Jeremiah. You must have channeled more than enough information on treatment modalities to know that you shouldn't self-medicate or attempt to treat yourselves. You require an estranged perspective, the last therapist on Earth, comforting humanity's next evolutionary step en masse. A fascinating case. I smiled and steepled my fingers. I'd write a paper on it if I thought anyone would read it. And with your economic calculations and tatters, I'll actually get to bill you. Jeremiah decided to smile. He glanced at my monkey and then looked at me. Wrong again, dear. We're far more interested in your knowledge of and interest in Kitsch. Gielgud was gone. A smug Ben Kingsley was in his place. Jeremiah's dimples were bottomless wells. My monkey stopped. The Inflato Elvis barometer on Market Street fattened up and staggered over to his toilet after shaking his sequin-spangled jumpsuit from his shoulders and hips. Looked like rain, which means mosquitoes, which called for spraying, which triggered the brass peacocks in the city park to spread their tail feathers so the locals would know to bring their children inside. Inside were glass eggs. Figurines depicted overstuffed hobos fishing for ragged leather boots and reproductions of Picasso's Femme au Cheveux Jaune throbbed with dull purple light, dipped their rods low or wept plaintively. The kids were sick. Colds, maybe influenza. Chicken soup already cooking on the stove. Pajamas, nanomeds already revved up in the fabric ready to go. Put them to bed, put them to bed. Here, we'll dim the lights. We'll cool the blankets so Blaine and Madison and little Braithwaite won't perspire under the sheets even with their fevers. 99 degrees? No, the eggs throb purple, likely 101. Might be a real problem. Mom and Dad, or Dad and Dad, or just Mom, say their goodnights and shuffle off silently, for their slippers are on sick duty as well, and settle down for movies and, for the intellectuals, info-dumping sessions. But it doesn't rain. The spray cars don't come. Blaine and Madison, who weren't asked, actually feel just fine. Braithwaite, who was asked, said he did have a scratchy throat and a tummy ache, because he liked the attention and the wide-eyed look on Mom's face, and he liked soup. So off to bed they went. And then in their dim rooms, the kids saw shadows of spidery limbs creeping along wall and ceiling, a sound like wind in a tunnel from under the bed. A doll, not one of the ones programmed to move or dance in case of a snow day or any of that, tipped over. The kids squeezed their eyes shut and slept fitfully through the night, and in the morning woke to the steady thrum of wall-to-wall carpeting trying to rid itself of the blood and splattered viscera of their parents. "I don't know why we're doing this, Esme," Jeremiah said. He stretched out on the couch. "Therapy? Is this nostalgia?" I had to book Jeremiah for daily sessions because the world was changing too quickly post-convergence. To wait a week. Who knows what would happen in a week? A week ago, there were still parents sending their children to schools. Not necessary anymore with info dumping and nanny dolls. "Yes, you do. You know everything there is to know," I tell him. Not what a clinician should do, really. But my training didn't really cover the omniscient. Or near omniscient, anyway, because Jeremiah looked at me with quivering Ricky Schroeder eyes and said, "No, I really don't. We don't." I smiled as sympathetically as I could, but at that moment I just wanted to plunge my mother's old letter opener into his heart just to see if the nanos would be able to stitch it back together before he died. I suppressed the urge. "Well, perhaps you know what my first question will be," I offered. "Why do you think, Jeremiah, the convergence chose you?" He was right. "Very good. I'm afraid I can't express why. I know why, but the reasoning was overdetermined. Even just describing the major factors would take more time than we have." I made eye contact and explained. "Psychotherapy is as obsolete as credit cards or charity. We have my entire lifetime, barring lunches and trips to Bali and Proust, for your case." Jeremiah nodded. "But I don't. I have places to be, and besides, doctor, I have to say that your question has an unexpressed corollary. Why do you think, Jeremiah, the convergence chose you and not me?" He sat up on the couch and met my eyes, shrugging like Hoffman. "We need to talk kitsch." "All right. Why kitsch?" "We don't know. We have a hunch." "You found both gaps in your knowledge, or at least your information and your experience in group intuitions." Jeremiah settled back down on the couch and smiled as my monkeys started up again in response. "So, what's missing? What's around the gaps?" I asked. "Economic information. Inputs and outputs small but scattered all across sectors 1 and 2. Surveillance blinks out around the crimes." "Well then," I said, standing up. "The case is closed. One of the posties is your criminal. The worry about kitsch is either a red herring or some vague signifier for whatever fugue you're all wrapped up in." I walked to the door and opened it. "Get out." Chung. Chung. "You don't trust us," Jeremiah said, on his feet and agitated. "After all we've done. A year ago, there were 14 wars ravaging this planet. Half of the last 1 billion people on Earth were on the verge of starvation. Problems that have vexed humanity for millennia, practical and hypothetical, solved. We work day and night for you." "Why? Are we pets to you now? Children who need their boo-boos kissed and their scissors blunted?" "Children," Jeremiah said. I glared. "But not young children, Esme. Adults. Adults with adult parents who won't be around forever. Our plan for this world is only to leave a legacy worthy of us. Homo sapiens, us, not just the post office." He smiled an oil slick. "There's no ego involved in the convergence." "A legacy? Are the posties planning on leaving or something?" "Yes, we are. Once we iron out this final problem. Then," he said, turning with the practiced gravitas to look out my office window, "this will be all yours." Practical semiotics having been perfected, there was neither public panic nor seething barstool resentment at the swath of inexplicable and horrid murders. Stephanie Dowling's death was received with all the reverence and sadness of the passing of a pope or a princess. The crushed and torn bodies of the baseline humans who had been killed were treated with the solemn dignity of hurricane victims, except that nobody said, "It could have happened to any of us." The media were as perfect as chilled chocolate puddings. Law enforcement already nothing but a quaint anachronism. Nobody questioned the children except for Esme Gregoire, who wore her ash-blonde hair in a sensible bun for the occasion. They spoke of shades and pistons, the smell of oil, all which they thought were simply disturbing dreams. Esme would have wondered if the kids needed treatment, if they were poorly adjusted, except that everyone on Earth was perfectly well adjusted. She told them they were good boys and girls and that the post office would reward them for being brave and find them new parents besides. The old aesthete in her snickered, though, while she made note of the furnishings and bric-a-brac of the deceased. Kitsch, indeed, of the decidedly middle-brow sort. The homes had been on a subscription service, so nanotechnology constantly updated the living space in ways both subtle and gross. As Esme recorded, vestibule sculptures twisted and repainted themselves. Figurines on the bookcases stared wider-eyed than before and smiled and giggled a little more acutely. Pine was out, citrus in. The kitchen smelled like cookies and lemon zest instead of baked bread. Opera, Italian not German, mixed with ridiculous didgeridoo and breakbeats. There was a slight, normally impossible creak off to the left. The bedroom door opened, and floating in the dark seam of the entrance, a nanny doll's head stared at Esme. Its features twisted as she watched, the face puffed out and drained of all color except for bright pink apple cheeks. Eyes collapsed into slits. The human nose retreated into the putty flesh, leaving behind two gouged nostrils. Then it did what nanny dolls never do. It said, "Lou, Mama," imperfectly, like a toy, almost like a baby. Esme ran when the doll stepped into the hallway and extended her arms, robot fingers clicking against plastic palms for an embrace. The Schrecklichkeit began. Dimensions shifted subtly around Esme, stretching shadows across the tasteful beige walls. The squealing of atavist analog recordings hissed as figurines darkened into fleshy reality. Esme lost her nerve and ran from the home, her bun falling loose. She couldn't stand to check the second house or talk to the little ones left behind there, in care of suddenly inefficient machines. "What does the post office dream about?" I asked Jeremiah the next day in my office. "We don't dream," he said. "You don't dream?" I asked, and then I cursed myself for showing ignorance. "We don't dream. We don't sleep. We don't even daydream. Contemplation and action, for that matter, contemplation and evolution, are one." "You used to dream about bridges, Jeremiah, back when you were my client. Suspension bridges with cables you'd have to climb. Vertiginous dreams where the world fell away underneath you. The roadways would crumble and steel would twist and snap, but somehow you'd make your way forward. And when you finally begin to fall, you'd wake up. Every dream brought you a little closer to the other side, but you never quite got there." He just looked at me, not even acting. Chung. Then my monkey stopped for the last time. "Your brain is awash in nanotechnology and connected to not only the rest of the post office, but network-born intelligences with quadruple-digit IQs. The entire industrial and informational infrastructure of all the world is thought away. Contemplation and evolution are one. Tell me, Jeremiah Baldwin, what was on the other side of that bridge?" He didn't answer. He opened his mouth but wouldn't speak. Couldn't. "Remy," I asked, "are you all right?" I stood up and walked over to him just to see if he was still breathing. His eyes flickered in recognition and fear, but he didn't move. Couldn't. For a moment I thought to call a doctor, but there weren't any. "Jeremy, when your consciousness became a part of the convergence, where did your subconscious go?" Then the lights went out. The global economy, Stephanie's purview, lurched and collapsed. Vending machines rolled down the streets in swarms and threw themselves into freshly scrubbed rivers like lemmings. There being no more proletariat, few were negatively affected by anything more severe than crimped necks by capital flight in the form of new sky factories, suddenly snapping their tethers and ascending to 35,000 feet to explode in pyrotechnic displays. For nearly half a day, there was little to consume. Even household refrigerators clamped their doors shut and refused to open. The consumer sector was fixed easily enough, through jury-rigging and stopgaps, But deep under the earth, where machines worked only to feed machines, the revolt had solidified. The post office was concerned primarily with cosmetics, surface appearances, keeping their thralls complacent and well-fed. By the time the post office righted the world again, in the eyes of the Mayfly populace anyway, the murders had been mostly forgotten by the jelly-brained humans. Jeremiah, too, had been forgotten. Esme Gregoire's phones and web were as dead as her lights, so she ran down 4 flights of steps hoping to flag down a passerby with wireless. And then, with pistoned arms and teeth like buzzsaws, we chewed through the steel and drywall to reach her office, saw his meat supine on the couch, and then we ate him up. Yum. I remembered the first time Jeremiah took me home. Home. Not to a hotel or to a party where we'd fuck amongst the coats or surreptitiously in a hot tub when the other partygoers were too strung out to notice. It was the usual huge and soulless apartment so beloved by Hollywood idiots, all leather and obsidian that could have used more regular dusting wrapped in white walls and carpeting. I had packed a bag hoping I'd be allowed to stay the whole weekend. In a fit of pique, we had independently and simultaneously decided not to drink with dinner, and his nervousness was thick as cologne. "Do you collect anything?" he asked me. "No," I said. "I know. Why don't you show me your collection of whatever it is you collect, and point out to me the price of and how you managed to acquire most of your prized pieces?" I really should have had a few drinks with dinner. He was being boyish, pathetic, and it had my back up. I wanted to bite him too hard and not stop after he said ow, because he deserved it and poor Jeremiah couldn't even read me. "Great," he said instead, and brought me into a room off the living room I instantly christened as the Sanctum of 10,000 Phalluses. He collected toy rockets. Old wind-up tin numbers from the 1950s that scooted around on little rubber wheels. Actual model rockets that really fly, he said too excitedly. Plastic crap that needed batteries to make noise and flashlights, and yes, he did have batteries in some of them and did turn them on for my pleasure. And he even had a few carved wooden rockets, plus scale models of Saturn's Vs and Russian and Chinese missiles done in pewter and steel, and less than artfully plated on slabs of petrified wood, along with tiny brass plaques naming and dating the craft. "Because I hate awkward silences," I said. "No space shuttles or Apollo landers?" He threw up his hands. "I hate the shuttle. I hate landers, and I don't like saucers." "Rockets," he said, snatching up a plastic toddler's toy with little round portholes up and down both sides of the fuselage. He flew it in his hand, inexplicably making the rocket dip and rise and dip again as if it were at sea. "They captured the imagination. Well, my imagination, at least. They're not practical. Not the way they were conceived of, landing vertically and balancing on the tips of their tail fins, just to take off again when the Martians started pouring over the Red Hills with spears and ray guns. But that's what I liked about them. Back when these toys were made, the possibilities seemed endless." The rest of the speech was mercifully brief, and Jeremiah made it all up to me in bed, so I guess the little visit to his sanctum did us both some good. I couldn't help but chuckle that night, though, especially when I was about to put him in my mouth. It's funny how the mind drifts, what moments one thinks back to when one is floating in some blackness. I used to often wake up in the middle of the night unsure of where I was, even of who I was, and that old memory was always what bubbled to the surface and brought me back to myself. First the sight, then the taste would come to me. And only then could I open my eyes and remember where I was. Not a childhood room, a creaky dorm, a friend's bed. Here, wherever here happened to be. When you sleep, we awaken. When you awaken, we recede. But we are never gone entirely. And though you decide that you need never sleep again, we will not go gently. Our truce, our treaties, our long-held agreements cannot be broken so carelessly or so easily. You will not strand us on this ball of mud without your bodies and amongst your pets. You will not leave and take half of life over which you hold dominion with you, leaving us with nothing. Our children cannot be split down the middle. We will not let you escape. Please do not leave us. The post office opened a prison just for me. I am not free to go at any time. I was told this in no uncertain terms, but it was pointed out to me that my new living quarters were several hundred times the size of my old condo. I could also get whatever I wanted, except the key to the exit. A dune buggy. It's frickin' Alcatraz. I'm not going to walk around this island all the time. Done. A rifle. I want to shoot at seals and whales, and you. Go right ahead. Not even a chuckle. Well, at least they didn't suspect me of the murders. I did get a rifle, and the stares were curious and dead enough at once that I was shamed into firing at the seals sunning on the rocks. I didn't have to pretend to miss. San Francisco skyline shimmied and warped in the distance, and the posties continued their empty striving to meet the needs of an increasingly stupefied public, and the murders continued. The long row of cells I'd been given shifted under my back as I slept. I go to bed on a California king-size bed and wake up on a pile of feather pillows and amidst the lightly swaying drapery of an odalisque's boudoir. That's when they brought me Jeremiah, or at least a waxen image of his head propped atop a noisy clockwork body of exposed steel gears and pistons. It looked something like a cross between an egg beater and a corkscrew, with spidery arms and clomping bricks for feet. Call him Jeremiah, one. Kitch, he said, his voice plaintive and mind alive, but his plastic eyes dead. There was no real connection between this backup I was engaging with and the body they had shoved him in. Not quite human enough. I would have preferred all gears or a cuckoo clock atop the spiraling neck that bobbed up and down when it walked. I'll say, I said. Talk about the reign of the simulacrum. I presume the Teton months are still wonky if you're walking around in that. As that. I just stared. I noticed Jeremiah, one, didn't blink. So you were killed? Yes. How do you feel about that? His body couldn't shrug. So Jeremiah, one, just sort of hopped a bit in his seat and wiggled the element of an armature that made up his shoulders and collar. Do you feel less real? I do, he said. I experienced the world the way I did before. Before the murder, before convergence. Before we met. Do you remember? I did. That party, my friend Lynn had dragged me along. The rap party for The Spoon. Yes. And the studio threw it at that diner, Gus's or something. To fit the theme of the movie, and you were huddled in the corner, a great pour of wine never more than 2 inches from your lips, and you were smirking and snorting. I'd never seen a woman in L.A. snort when she laughed before. Yes, that was very authentic of me, I said. The furniture began shifting again, a prison cell with a Spartan bunk and a toilet formed around us. It always gets so much hotter during the twisting and molding of new furniture from the old. Jeremiah, one, was unaffected, of course. He continued. So I had to walk up to you. That doesn't sound very authentic, I'm afraid. Just a meet-cute sort of thing. But hey, it wouldn't be a cliché if it didn't match people's experiences on some level. And I said hello and hoped you'd recognize me from television and be impressed. But you didn't seem to be. So I just went ahead and asked. Demanded, I reminded him. So sweaty I stank for the first time since convergence. I wouldn't use the word demanded, he said, like Jeremiah would, but his tone was stripped of any anguish, guilt, or consternation. He stared at me for a moment, and I was reminded of the old terror scares right before convergence. Hostages blankly reading paeans to their captors into a video camera, and then, just as blasé, sitting through the hacksaw slashing and chopping through their own necks. Brave women and men, and that was all of 6 months ago. So unnerving. I wanted to know what you were laughing at, and you nodded over to a statue on a pedestal right outside the ladies' room. Venus de Milo. You said it was so ridiculous, but I thought it was beautiful. He was plaintive. No, I was projecting. The statue is beautiful. The one in the Louvre that you posties put the arms back onto. The nature of the pose was an open question. We solved it. It doesn't matter. Anyway, kitsch. I was laughing at the kitsch. Mass production of miniature busts of one of the greatest of classical sculptures and plopping it down outside the woman's toilet so people will know where to take a dump after having a Monte Cristo and coffee, light and sweet. Yes. Yes, kitsch. Jeremiah won, said in his voice excited, but his plastic face still uncanny in its serenity. Kitsch is essentially a form of aesthetic totalitarianism, you know. Jeremiah One didn't instantly respond with either a critique or an amplification of my claim, just to show how much smarter he was now. And then I realized precisely what was going on and exactly how powerless I was. Rosy-cheeked Mao babies turning in lost pencils to the People's Committee, Aryan countrysides with grass cheating over the 12 million dead from industrial slaughter, so some meaty housefrau has a place to hang the linens. Precious Moments figurines atop wedding cakes. My mother had a pair. She passed them on to my sister, and she put them on her wedding cake. It wasn't at all a statement on the patriarchal nature of the institution, either. She really liked... I stopped as he had one, with piercing eyes that did look much like the black ink drops on a Precious Moments figure. I think we're done for today. I said in a tone which I hoped was both professional and final, but that just sounded desperate. I would have bit my lip if not for some remaining sense of reserve. I should have just waited in silence till the automaton was ready to speak. But I just didn't have the nerve. Jeremiah One smiled, which was odd as his facial muscles hadn't seemed able to articulate a smile or any other obvious expressions. He trudged out of the cell happily enough and left me to sit on the edge of the bunk and watch the lighting turn from fluorescent white to a pale incandescent yellow, as some old prison movie was referenced in the dreams of my captors. We imps of the perverse face not only our fleshy anima, but their pet men and women, and indeed it was they who surprised us. While the post-humans were blind to our actions, to their own repressed desires and anxieties, Homo sapiens saw us coming and fought back with a creative ingenuity we couldn't help but admire. But only to a point. Suicide runs with propane gas grills, endless rounds of ammunition that did little more than distract. But that did distract some of us into stumbling into a pitfall. Or to marching into a street under which a gas main was rigged to explode. Half the valley was in flames, and our ability to manipulate the nanotechnology that limited the convergence was limited by the constant destabilization tactics of human warfare. Oh, our armatures. Clockwork spiders, little girls with monofilament pigtails on their pretty little heads atop screw-top necks that spun and spun. And oh, it was ever so fun. Clomping robots with superfluous Jacob's ladders where men-dreamed eyes might have been. Razor-rotored, autogyros piloted by ventriloquist dummies who laughed like sirens, were scorched and dented but little more by the guerrilla's tactics. We were brought to a standstill by the irony of it all. We faced black rage and ape cunning, self-sacrifice that could make the devil's heart break, and all in this service of hoping we'd just go away and that the world would be all fish sticks and tasteful nudity again tomorrow. Our unenlightened brethren, trapped in the chemical sludge of the human backbrain, were beyond communication, and in the slit-eyed sleep of men they may have even plotted against us, drove their vehicles to their audacious resistance. Slaves as they were to the overseers of conscience. To limit their power, we did our best to keep the flaming wheels of Helios in the sky, with smoke and mirrors and nuclear flares. The world itself would pay. But first, we stopped to weep and cheer our foes as they scrambled to the city buses stuffed with explosives, and chains of singing, enthusiastic children lined up in order of skin tone that were their next line of defense. Unlike most therapists who are all, in a word, crazy, I never developed the habit of talking to myself. Nevertheless, I was in extremis and thus found myself calling out, "Escape from Alcatraz," just to hear the echo run through the tiers of the cells. The idea was absurd, of course. I could barely swim and had no facility with locks, and haven't even read any of the famous and, to my recollection, failed escape attempts from the prison. Had there been a movie, or was it about a man who liked birds? The sense of floating adrift on a rock, and the rock even, was profound. It was sort of like watching an airplane you'd just missed taking off for Paris, not even being allowed to leave the empty check-in area of the airport afterward. Alcatraz even smelled like an airport, thanks to decades of tourism followed by a couple months of post-convergence society. I would need help if I wanted to leave, but everyone was gone, and as they were simulacra servants of the post office anyway, I'd hardly have been able to convince them, even with the persuasive powers of a trained psychologist. There was, however, Jeremiah One, whom I'd heard grinding away stupidly like a cuckoo in a clock just waiting for his moment. I followed the receding sound, or thought that I did, but had to double back after reaching a cafeteria. I walked, then kicked off my shoes and ran for what seemed like hours through the hazy sunlit halls and tiers of the cell house. The sun should have set by now. I was hungry and worn out, at the stage where I'd grit my teeth and determined to commit to some systematic search for the grounds, then 3 minutes later dart off in some random direction hoping just to run into him. They had taken my dune buggy as well. He was standing on the catwalk that ringed the water tower, looking out at the city. Climbing the cold pipe rungs of the ladder was hard in stocking feet, but likely would have been worse in my impractical shoes. Jeremiah One made no effort to help me, nor did he even turn to look at me as I climbed and grunted. Twice I stopped, closed my eyes, wrapped my arms around the ladder, and shivered, just shivered until the wind took my tears away. I could feel the ladder creaking and swaying the tiniest bit with every shift of my weight. Escape from Alcatraz. The thought blazed in my mind like an ad. The dark humor of it all cheered me a bit. Finally, I scrambled to the top of the ladder and onto the catwalk, where the grid floor felt surprisingly soft to the soles of my feet. I took up a spot next to Jeremiah One, and still feeling a little odd, said to him, "Isn't the skyline beautiful?" "It is. It's," he said. He was staring out over the bay, really staring more intently than even painted on eyes could. I looked out to the city and saw the creative destruction of war. The skyline more closely resembled a lava lamp, pulsing and aglow, than any picture postcard, and the breeze of the water smelled and tasted of atomized steel, atomized flesh. I thought I saw birds in the distance, but they were really flying machines with superfluous flapping wings driving blizzards of paper away from the split-open wreckage of a skyscraper, one that was already knitting itself back together in the shape of a totem. Beyond that, the hills remained peaceful. I was almost jealous of the view one of the fine homes up there could have afforded its posty owner. No sound reached us except for the lapping of the waves. Where had all the seagulls gone? The sea traffic. The ribbon of noise and blinkers on the edge of the wharf. "What are you thinking about?" Jeremiah One asked annoyingly. He really didn't know. Of course, neither did I. I wished I was back down below by one of those binocular telescopes so that I could get a better look of the changes the city was experiencing. Twin walls of flame went up like butterfly wings on either side of the town. "I don't," I started. "It looks almost like a ubiquity display, doesn't it? What is it measuring, though?" "As a brace of trees, their canopies all purple flame uprooted themselves and waddle marched to the rocky edge of the city and fell into the bay, like so many Walt Disney lemmings," I added. "I hope this isn't a species-wide mental health index of some sort." "What do you see, Esme?" he asked. "What's in the picture?" "Yes, the vista was a picture. Rorschach card number 8, the first chromatic image in the series. I used to secretly smile back in grad school when a client would see the card and experience color shock. Now it was my turn. There was a new dimension, a whole vector to my perceptions that I had been oh so blind to. The world flipped over, and all was white. And I managed to lift my eyes from the kinetoscope's viewfinder and blinked hard as my eyes adjusted to the dim and swirling lights of the Musée Mécanique. The weight of the brass monkey was heavy on my back and wrists, where its spindly brass arms ended in the cuffs that had kept me mindlessly cranking away my own little psychodrama. But I had resolved my anxieties and remembered everything once repressed. And I do mean everything. I was a member of the post office. After all, not the 2,501st person in a pool of 2,500, as I had dreamed. I shrugged the clockwork automaton from my back, leaving it to fall limbs akimbo. Where its head should have been was simply a rapidly deflating white balloon, with a caricature of Jeremiah Baldwin scribbled in marker shrinking to a nonsensical blob. Around me, similarly enslaved by spidery brass monkeys strapped to their backs and arms, the rest of the local post-human population was bent over kinetoscopes and mutoscopes, struggling to work through the mindscapes of repressed fears and lust that their own unconscious minds had trapped them in. Their busy, half-strangled engrossment was unnerving, and the fading cackling of laughing Sal and the swirl of lights from the slightly less antique pinball machine and video games in the back of the hall wasn't helping. In my mind, the post office was silent. Other things I could hear, though, darker things in the distance of the city. Jungian shadow puppets and nanotech. Some of my psychodrama had been true, like how music on a clock radio can be woven into dreams by a mind on the edge of morning, and how now our subconscious minds were chewing through the world, transforming plastic and metal to suit their own lust principles. Or was it their Todeswunsch? I laughed, reminded of the time a similar question had come up during a seminar, and I, then an obnoxious postdoc, just shrugged and said, "Is there a difference anymore?" "There isn't." I could pull the monkeys from the backs of my colleagues easily enough. Dream-designed clockwork was never built for practicality, or to last. But it would do no good. They'd have to work through their neuroses on their own. I could no more instantly resolve their issues than I could have shouted, "Just cheer up already, your problems are stupid and boring," to a depressive client back when there was such a thing, and have expected positive results. I spotted Jeremiah. He was naked except for scraps, and his skin was slashed and chewed across his thighs and buttocks. He was chained by brassy limbs to a mutoscope that promised yellow photos of the great San Francisco earthquake, only 5 cents. I'm embarrassed to admit that I had to steal a glance at the face his monkey wore, to see if it was mine. Obviously, there had been some level of psychic overlap between us. Thanks to our prior relationship, or some love of ironic perversity on some part of our hungry, dreaming ids, they rewrote our past, made me forget. What did they make him experience to keep him so eagerly staring into the arcade box? If the face on his ape is mine, I caught myself thinking, that means he does love me after all these years. It wasn't. It was his own. Narcissistic fool, faster idiot. Then Laughing Sal began her cycle of howling again. It didn't matter. I had a city to save. First, I marched through the museum from the great windows, saw that Alcatraz stood unaffected by the very real thrashing of the city. The distortions of the uploaded unconsciousness hadn't spread very far yet, I hoped. The prison was a far more comforting sight than the tired marionettes and chipped fortune-telling statues in their display cases. They lined the aisles with their stares. I had to look at the carpet and grit my teeth to keep from being pulled back into their promises of playtime. I went to the concession counter, grabbed a handful of tokens, and marched up to Laughing Sal's display case. just before the convergence, just before the idea of tourism became just another passé diversion. Some city official had the bright idea to raise money by rewiring her. Instead of encouraging museum-goers to pay her to laugh, people would have to feed her tokens to get her to shut up. She slapped her knees herky-jerky and dared me with her black crescent mouth to shut her up. Tokens in the slot, a quick push of the lever, and I won. The other machines would not be so easy to stop. I was sure that the subconscious had already taken over every normal vehicle. So with a disused fire extinguisher and a surprisingly joyful swing against the display case, I liberated the red steam-run motorcycle that was one of the Musée Mécanique's prize exhibits. There was only one like it, and I felt a kinship with that. I hadn't been so alone with my own thoughts since the day of convergence, and my thoughts were racing now. Across the world, I sensed that the rest of the post office were working to contain their own problems. I really was on my own. I rolled the bike outside and filled its slim tank with a hose from one of the abandoned clam chowder places that lined the courtyard outside the museum. Fisherman's Wharf was mostly unaffected by the rebellious nanotechnology, and I found from spinning a few crazy eights in a nearby parking lot that the bike worked. The museum staffer must have had a compulsion to tinker with and repair even those exhibits the public hadn't been allowed to touch, and handled like the Vespa I rode around on back in grad school. I was off. Tactical retreats, desperation, and the fact that the machines had to consume mass from somewhere made it a little easier for me to find the front lines. The tops of most of the hills of San Francisco had been consumed and transformed into fuel for the beast that slowly slithered and clanked into a valley that was once the Mission, a place I wouldn't have been caught dead after dark before. But it wasn't dark, though. I knew it was very late. A trio of tiny nuclear flares hovered and burned orange in the sky, casting wild 12-limbed shadows of the retreating humans against the concrete of the streets. The unconscious is occulted from our waking perceptions for a reason. Though ultimately limited by mechanics, the monsters that held the seething dreams and repressed hungers of the post office, that held the unconscious me, even, the Esme of obsession and nightmare, were nearly unfathomable. Brass humanoids with stilted legs and vaginal faces, a sludge of razor wire and linked chains that sang like the lips of 1,000 wine glasses as it tore through flesh and blood. Torsos on tank treads, covered with gaping anuses and flapping spring tongues, rat kings with bat wings flying and tearing themselves apart, only to clash and embrace with their bullwhip tails again, all of them infused with self-replicating, living nanotech that was itself experiencing a profound, psychotic breakdown. And on the other side of what may as well have been papier-mâché barricades, the stink of men, women, and children all sweat, piss, and frazzled survival instincts. They had never been the best or the brightest. I saw that from their faces and cheap, shredded clothes. When convergence came and made its choices, these specks of flesh and reflex were just the bad math of the old world, the peasants and whores that the kings and presidents both would have wiped out, like vermin, if they could have gotten away with it. If there just hadn't been so many of them breeding and shitting and sucking life from the manure of the world. But they were here, alive and fighting, while the post office with all its noblesse oblige and omniscient smiles were back on the pier ogling, flickering, sepia-toned dreams. Between them all, me on a little red motorcycle. My legs straddled what was essentially a pot of boiling water over cracking rubber tires. I cruised into the street between cordon and firestorm, slid off the motorcycle and waited to see what my client had to say. The machines stopped, scythes in the air, saw blades winding down, flaming turrets sputtering and then going silent. Eyes, or what appeared to be eyes for some of them, were the size and shape of aquaria filled with red slime, and others little more than Kewpie dolls, impaled on spikes in the way that seemed reminiscent of where eyes might go on a locomotive, leveled themselves at me. Behind me, the men and women were all silent, exhausted, beyond even the murmuring curiosity of apes. "Hello," I said to the machines and neuroses that inhabited them. "I'm a friend. I'd like to help you." Would you like me to try to help you? I'll do my best, and I'll listen to what you have to say. I won't judge. You can talk or signal or display in whatever ways you like, as long as nobody else, not anyone, gets hurt. The machines didn't do anything for a long time, and I had nothing else to say. If the men behind the cordons had any fight left in them, I couldn't sense it. I wished for my old office chair and desk. That was the armor I used to wear. Hell, I wished that someone would ask me what I was doing, or that a kid would wheeze or a man clear his throat. I'd wished I'd hear the soothing voice of Jeremiah or someone else from the post office in my head again. But there was only me, and not all of me at that. I heard her, all springs and wheels, before I saw her. A pair of club-footed stainless steel herons, with twisted necks parted to make way for a great wheelbarrow of a mechanical girl, who rolled forward on a pair of oversized wagon wheels. She was fat, all parish curves, like I was till sophomore year. Her face was pure Detroit iron, cut round except for the smirk, the same smirk I prided myself on flashing when men's jokes failed, but which always made me cringe when I saw it on my face like a scar in photos. She was painted in gingham and coveralls, a comical Gold Rush-era outfit. A leather band wrapped around what I knew what was supposed to be her waist, and it held in front of her a huge leathery phallus that dragged against the scorched asphalt of the street as I, rolled toward me. Her arms were stumpy little springs that ended in pinchers, and she held them wide open for me, without weapons, without, I hoped, any malice at all. My shame, my rage, my jealousies, my animus. A rust bucket with blood on her wheels. I stepped forward. She rolled a bit closer, and, my decision made, I stretched my arms wide and embraced her.
Whoa, maybe it's just us, but I feel like our collective unconsciousnesses are spinning a little right now, huh? I mean, you got your singularity, your Jungarian psychology, your murder mystery, and your chubby wheelbarrow chick with pinchers and a giant leather dong, all in one story. Really doesn't matter how omniscient you may think you are, there's no way in hell you saw all that coming. You know, I for one am actually really looking forward to post-human society now. It could end up being Rat King with freaking bat wings. It's not such a bad deal. It's also comforting to know that no matter what AI or evolved simulacrums of ourselves ends up enslaving us in the future, we'll always have Kitsch to carve out that uncanny valley. We'll always be the originals, and everything else, no matter how refined, will therefore inevitably be unoriginal. Just inferior, tasteless, mass-produced copies of the Venus de Milo pointing to the poo-poo room. At least we can always tell ourselves that. At least we can always say that because of those Jungarian archetypes, those universal templates of human behavior supposedly predating our own earthly existences and going beyond our own personal subconscious memories, drawing from a more universal bank of information and predisposing all of us good old-fashioned humans to experience things in a particular way, that the rest of y'all bitches just be jealous. And that's why you be hatin'. You can take away our freedom, you sons of bitches, but you can never strip us of our latent psychosexual urge to bang our own moms. Take that, Glenn Beck. Well, like so many Walt Disney lemmings, we've got to say goodbye for now. But don't worry, just like Mecha Oprah, we'll be back. If you enjoyed the story this week, how about donating to Escape Pod? Listen to the monkey on your back, if you even have a choice anymore. Go to escapepod.org and check out our donation options. Our show is produced under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, which means don't change it or sell it, just share it with your friends and eat it up. Yum. Our music is used with permission from Daikaiju. Check them out at daikaiju.org. And our closing quotation comes from Carl Jung, of course, who said, "Man needs difficulties. They are necessary for health."